Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have the Russian National Security Council recommending the liberalization of gas exports. According to the Russian Vedomosti newspaper and as quoted by Sputnik, the commission recommended the government to determine the priority directions of the state policy for development of the LNG industry, coordinate a strategy for gas delivery to target markets, and conditions for liberalization of gas export with the consideration of existing risks for economic security of Russia as the structure of energy demand in the world is changing. End quote. This is very important, because the articles note that thus far, only Gazprom has the authority to export pipeline gas from Russia, although other players such as Rosneft are allowed to partake in the LNG industry. What's important about this recommendation is that it implies that Gazprom's previously powerful influence, both on the Russian state and as a de facto foreign policy instrument of it, is fading, with its global reputation marred by several Western-provoked scandals. In its place is emerging Rosneft, whose name is officially a portmanteau that means Russian oil, but which has lately become more active in the gas sphere as well. Reuters published a thought-provoking analysis in late June, titled Russia's Rosneft Set for Global Gas Tussle with Gazprom, which briefly touched upon the emerging competition between these two companies, though crucially before the Russian National Security Council issued its recent recommendation. In light of what the experts suggested and given the context of the simmering rivalry between these two energy giants, it now appears as though Moscow has decided to experiment with encouraging more so-called friendly competition between them, understanding that both the market dynamics and strategic situation necessitate this if Russia is to effectively preserve the political influence that comes with its energy exports. The U.S. recently tightened its sanctions against Russian energy companies and broadened them to include some categories of the country's foreign partners as well. So it makes sense for Moscow to no longer remain solely dependent on one company for exporting its gas abroad. Although it doesn't look like Rosneft will outright replace Gazprom, Moscow appears to have concluded that the rivalry between them could help drive down operational costs and therefore make Russian resources even more competitive than they are in this era of low prices. In the future event that Rosneft ends up taking over some of Gazprom's investments through a buyout or whatever other means are available, then it might even help Russia start off with a fresh slate by removing the historical baggage of Gazprom from the equation and fostering more trust with the country's European partners. All in all, while it's difficult to predict what tangible manifestations this recommended policy could take if implemented, it's reasonable to suggest that the state-supported friendly competition between the two companies is being encouraged because of the expectation that it will work out to Russia's supreme benefit in one way or another. The next one up is Russia and China going along with the US-led UNSC sanctions against North Korea. A lot of people in the alternative media community were taken aback by Russia and China's decision, especially considering that it was undertaken in the context of the US recently passing more anti-Russian sanctions and even threatening to sanction China too, which has created the perception that both countries sold out to the US. It just doesn't make sense to some that these two multipolar great powers, who are presumably against the so-called New World Order, would do this. The reality, as it usually turns out to be, is a lot more complex than the simplistic arguments going around social media, and therefore deserves further elaboration so that individuals can independently make their minds up about what happened and why. Before going any further, an important clarification needs to be made. Although Russia and China are both multipolar great powers, they seek to gradually and stably reform the existing world order, not radically and chaotically change it like some so-called super patriotic pundits want to pretend. It's the US which regularly throws global affairs into uncertainty in the hopes of destabilizing its rivals and carving out strategic inroads amidst the chaos, not Russia and China, which prefer to engage in their long-term planning under conditions of global predictability. Given these strategic determinants influencing their decision makers, they're already predisposed to disliking North Korea's missile nuclear test, especially when they continue to occur in defiance of the existing UNSC sanctions that Moscow and Beijing approved of themselves. Moreover, Russia and China won't ever blindly support any state like North Korea just because the US is against it. Nor will they ever be comfortable with such a country doing whatever it wants under these circumstances if its actions contribute to more instability. No value judgment is being expressed here, just a statement of facts about Russia and China's state interests as gleaned from empirical evidence over the years. In the Northeast Asian context, North Korea's missile nuclear tests are creating the pretext to justify the US's THAAD deployment to the peninsula, which Russia and China both consider as a latent threat to their nuclear second strike capabilities with time. So, from their perspective, it makes sense why they'd want to put multilateral pressure on North Korea to end these destabilizing activities. What's essentially occurred is that the US has succeeded in shaping the situation in such a way that Russia and China's interests have largely converged with Washington's own in tightening sanctions against North Korea, and that this is independent of the recent anti-Russian sanctions or the grandstanding threats to impose economic restrictions against China. The US exploited Russia and China's strategic positions in favor of predictability and stability in convincing them to follow its lead in imposing new UNSC sanctions against North Korea, which also advances their own interest as described earlier, and additionally provides a proverbial opening for them to work on the improvement of bilateral relations after falling into their current slump. Whether one thinks that it was morally right or morally wrong, the fact remains that Russia and China approved the latest UNSC sanctions against North Korea because it corresponds to their grand strategic interest, not because they were forced to contradict them under American pressure. Third in our countdown is Singapore's paranoia in expelling a professor whom they accuse of being a foreign agent for an unnamed country. As reported by CNN, Professor Huang Jing is an American citizen and professor on U.S.-Chinese relations who is accused by Singapore's Ministry of Home Affairs of having, quote, used his senior position in the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy to deliberately and covertly advance the agenda of a foreign country at Singapore's expense, end quote. They also say that, to quote, he did this in collaboration with foreign intelligence agents. This amounts to subversion and foreign interference in Singapore's domestic politics, end quote, which apparently justify the cancellation of his and his wife's entry permits and their designation as prohibited immigrants. Nobody knows exactly who Professor Huang was supposedly spying for, but it's unlikely that it was the US, and speculation has abounded that it was actually China. The Ministry of Home Affairs says that he passed along so-called privileged information on behalf of the unnamed foreign state to prominent and influential Singaporeans, who in turn relayed some of it to senior officials who were in a position to act upon it. The official complaint also alleges that he tried to recruit others to assist with his operations. Because there aren't any more specific details other than that, it's hard to tell exactly what it was that Professor Huang was really doing. And the optics of the situation are such that it appears as though Singapore is behaving in an overly paranoid fashion concerning anything that might presumably have to do with China due to its perceived bias in favor of the US and the new Cold War. However, it could also be that Professor Huang was indeed used as a witting or unwitting agent of a foreign power's intelligence apparatus, which in that case would justify the action against him and his wife. The reason why it's so difficult to know what happened here is because many academics don't just teach students then go home for the day, but they regularly interact with prominent and influential people in the government, particularly in the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies, or so-called deep state, and also have high-level contacts with their foreign counterparts, both academic experts such as themselves and members of foreign deep states, whether they know about the latter or not. Academics who specialize in political affairs, especially those who are foreigners invited into a host country, are usually expected to fit this description because the government sometimes uses them as informal intermediaries abroad and as occasional analysts to brief their decision makers. From what is known, it looks like Professor Huang fit this description in every way. But the big question is whether or not he abused his position by becoming the agent of a foreign power, or is possibly even tricked into behaving as such. Experts such as himself, because of their access to the deep state, are prime intelligence targets. So this scenario certainly can't be discounted, even if Singapore does appear at this moment to have acted out of what seems to be paranoia. Our runner-up is the Turkish foreign minister trumpeting his country's strategic relations with China after a meeting with his counterpart on the sidelines of last weekend's ASEAN summit. As reported by Reuters, he said that, quote, "We take China's security as our security. We absolutely will not allow in Turkey any activities targeting or opposing China. Additionally, we will take measures to eliminate any media reports targeting China." End quote. The news outlet interpreted this as having to do with the Uyghurs, a Turkic people in China's northwestern autonomous province of Xinjiang. Some of them have received terrorist training abroad and returned back to their home region to carry out attacks, while others have immigrated, oftentimes illegally, to Turkey, which they regard as their civilizational homeland. Ankara had previously voiced official concern at the Chinese government's treatment of the Uyghur, and this was interpreted very negatively back in Beijing, where the authorities regard this issue as one of its most sensitive domestic topics. Moreover, some Uyghur terrorists traveled through Turkey on their way to Syria and joining Daesh, al-Nusra, and other such groups. And some reporters wondered aloud whether this was done with the government's complicity or allowed through its passive acceptance. Nevertheless, Turkey has fundamentally reoriented its geostrategic focus ever since the failed pro-American coup against President Erdogan last summer, and there are nowadays no chances whatsoever that the country would ever actively or passively go against China's interest, as can be seen most clearly through the bold statement of Foreign Minister Cavusoglu. I predicted this immediately after the regime change attempt when I wrote a very concise briefing titled, "Post-coup Turkey will be distinctly Eurasian," in which I made the forecast that Turkey would rapidly Turkey would of course love to become a transit state in facilitating EU-Chinese trade along the southern Eurasian rimland, but while the associated transport links may take some time to build yet, it could more immediately become the main partner for Chinese firms in the region. Turkish companies are active all throughout the Mideast, so the strategic partnership that China has clinched with the country allows it to use them as both its gateway and anchor in this part of the world, in exchange for the said firms receiving valuable investment and business deals. This works out to a classic win-win between both sides, but it's all conditional on Turkey ensuring that its territory isn't used for hosting any anti-Chinese elements, whether terrorist, media, or otherwise. At our top spot, we've got President of the European Council Donald Tusk warning that, quote, "There's a question mark over Poland's European future today," end quote. He issued his dramatic proclamation in response to a series of controversial moves that Poland has been taking concerning its judicial reforms. Refusal to relocate civilizationally dissimilar migrants to its soil, lack of enforcement of EU environmental legislation, and even questioning the former prime minister himself in a probe surrounding the 2010 plane crash in Smolensk that killed the ruling party leader's brother and former president. These are all very serious actions which indicate that Poland is pursuing a tougher line towards the EU and isn't afraid to express its national sovereignty, for better or for worse. Instead of discussing each of these events in detail, it's more relevant to ask whether they justify Tusk implying that Poland might be preparing to leave the EU, either on its own or after being kicked out, and the wild speculation that this caused about a so-called Polexit. To put it frankly, it's ridiculous to consider Poland leaving the EU, and Tusk is just fear-mongering to pressure Warsaw. Even though Poland faces imminent sanctions in the next month for defying the EU's migrant relocation orders, nobody is seriously talking about the country pulling a Brexit or being forced out. And the reasons behind that are simple enough to understand. From the Polish perspective, despite all the problems that the country has with the EU, it's still received over 250 billion euros from Brussels since its 2004 entry into the organization. And Poland also depends on the bloc's freedom of movement and employment as a pressure valve for lessening its unemployment and providing opportunities to the nearly 8 to 10% of its population which have already left for abroad. Lastly, EU leader Germany is by far Poland's top trading partner, so Warsaw can't afford to leave the bloc without experiencing severe economic consequences. On the other side, Germany needs Poland in the EU in order to indefinitely secure access to its cheap labor, both skilled and unskilled. It also appreciates Poland's geostrategic location in providing overland trade routes with its fellow Baltic EU members, Ukraine, Russia, and even China on the far end of the New Silk Road. However, there's another factor which importantly influences Germany's attitude towards Poland's EU membership, and it's that it fears that Warsaw could nationalize the tens of billions of dollars worth of investments that Germany and other EU companies made in the country since its 2004 ascension to the bloc as compensation for losing access to their markets. So what's Poland up to then if it's not preparing for a Polexit? Well, it envisions itself as the core state and the 12-member Central and Eastern European organization called the Three Seas Initiative, also known as the Intermarium, and believes that it can lead a movement in so-called New Europe to push the EU into agreeing to decentralization reforms that essentially devolve power to a collection of regional blocs. Basically, it doesn't want to break up the EU, but to launch a revolution within it. And that's why the powers that be are so scared that they want to topple the government. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my show. Hope you all have a nice weekend and that you'll tune in again on my program next week. Thanks. Bye.